The OTB Brief. Everything you need to know about sport every morning. Need to get on top of the day's sports news? Well, the OTB Brief is the only sports update you'll need every morning. With all the breaking stories, post-match reaction.
I always look about, you know, teams who've won a league, their mindsets, their body language, their hunger, desire. And I see that so much in this Liverpool team.
And the best bits from off the ball, all in a 10-minute podcast.
Rory McIlroy's game has changed a lot.
The OTB Brief. Weekday mornings from 7:20 a.m. on OTB Sports Radio. Listen on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power.
Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
What's football about? You're at Wembley Stadium, and a ball is crossed from the right wing, and you go, boom, boom.
That's his medal.
People say to me, was that the most memorable day of your life? Joyce and management are totally different to Joyce as a player.
He's not the same, Jack. He's dementia.
I couldn't remember a lot of the memories.
And it's a shame because he's had some good memories.
Jack, perfect goal!
Ireland was engulfed in war and conflict.
Nobody would have given you odds that we'd have an Englishman manage the team.
Our way of playing is completely new.
If you didn't like it, tough luck.
My brother Jack was an uncompromising character.
Jack said, if you don't get off the bus today, you'll never play for this country again.
This is a time when it gives you the opportunity now, not only to go. Come on.
You couldn't feel the spirit of the camp.
Another magnificent chapter in Jack Charlton's career.
I think a lot of you don't in Ireland.
No idea.
Bobby did what Bobby wants to do.
I love them.
Now hit me, come on! Rub it!
Never assume they know and understand.
We took that flag back and flew it with pride. Jack Charlton did that.
He's done more in his lifetime than people would do in 10 lifetimes.
Be a dictator, but be a nice one.
Now, very happy to say that Gabriel Clark is our next guest. He is very much involved with the Finding Jack documentary. I know lots of you out there are looking forward to seeing it. It has gone on general release. Gabriel, it's great to have you with us. Thanks so much for the time.
Pleasure to see you, John.
I presume not quite the general release you were planning for.
No, it was all set to go for a cinema release as well at the start of November. November 6th was our day, and I think 35 screens in Ireland. We're ready to go. But then, of course, lockdown arrived, maybe a little bit earlier in Ireland than it did in the UK. But we're still hopeful that in Ireland, when you open up again, that the cinemas concerned still, I think, feel that there'll be an audience there who'll want to go and see the film in the cinemas. And that'll be absolutely wonderful, because I think it's certainly a piece that, well, whenever you try and do a film, you want to have that particular audience in mind as well. And I think even if, put it this way, I would say this, wouldn't I? But even if you watch the film at home, go and see it in the cinema as well, because I think it'll be a great experience.
I've just watched it this morning. It's very emotional for understandable reasons. Loads in it I want to talk to you about. Maybe just to kick us off though, what surprised you about Charlton or about those Irish years?
Well, I knew those Irish years pretty well from being at World Cup 94, watching from a more of a distance in 90 and certainly 88 when I was just making my way in journalism. But I remember vividly the match in 88. So I think what surprised me more about the years wasn't the football, it was starting to investigate the transformational effect from maybe more of a UK perspective on Ireland, the country. And so interviewing people like Roddy Doyle and Larry Mullen, Brendan O'Connell, Niall Quinn, those that were closely associated with that time and who felt that Ireland was being transformed with the big help of the football team's success from sort of 86 through to 96. And it was, so it wasn't so much what surprised me about Jack, it was what surprised me about those years in relation to what Jack achieved. So I think that was something that from being over in the UK, we wanted to investigate. So having it underlined very much so by people who lived it, like Larry Mullen and Roddy Doyle, was fascinating. Hmm.
How is he regarded in the UK? Is he still very much 1966 Jack, or has the Irish stuff loomed large and how he's remembered? I guess it's a combination of both for a lot of people, I'm sure. But how would you say he is regarded over in the UK, over in England?
Well, it was interesting doing the documentary, and the documentary is from an the central narrative, in a football sense, is the Ireland story, because I feel that that is, and I think Jack felt as well, that that was obviously the most sustaining achievement of his life in football. But when he died, a lot of the tributes, of course, centered around 66 and also his broader career as a footballer. And it was a reminder to us, whilst we were still editing, that he did achieve so much. So we were careful in the film then to make sure that we underlined some of that incredible football achievement. This is a man who was Footballer of the Year as a centre-half in 1967, who won league titles, FA Cups, as well as, of course, the World Cup, and achieved a great deal in his own playing career. It was just that it was overshadowed by his brother. How's he regarded? He's regarded, I think, the Ireland story certainly plays into the way in which he became a bigger figure in the UK. I think there was an awful lot of respect for what he achieved as Ireland manager, because of course, England never beat Ireland during Jack's time in charge. But I do feel, and this was one of the reasons for making the film, was that bigger transformational achievement, an Englishman going to Ireland and doing what he did, wasn't really respected in the way that it might have been by a UK audience. Mm. And that was one of the key reasons for making the film in the first place.
I was very curious to see what new footage you dig up. And the piece that jumps to mind, I suspect lots of people have said this to you, is post-defeat to Italy at Italia 90. And the team are sitting around just kind of a courtyard terrace area at their hotel. And it's not a big crowd. It's not a big crowd. It's not full of hangers-on. It's not the raucous scenes that we all have in our head. It's very intimate and it's not drunken. It's like sentimental, you know? It's like the journey's over and they're almost enjoying each other's company. And there's some really beautiful singing in there, you know? I think they're singing Dublin in the Rare Old Times, I think, is sung, and Jack knows the words, and then Jack sings a song on his own.
And right.
You could see the players kind of looking over them and loving that they were sharing this with them. You know, weirdly, Christopher Berg was there and he did Hey Jude with, obviously, Hey Jack. But it wasn't like, you know, Christopher Berg wasn't one of 100 celebrity hangers on there. Again, it was very much the team. I'd never seen this footage before. And man, it's beautiful. Like, it's really beautiful. Where has this been for the last 30 odd years?
Well, I'm really delighted you say that, because I think for obviously a lot of Ireland fans and people who know the story, have seen the footage, who've been told the story, we had to be original with the way that we approached this film. And that meant not only obviously original filming with Jack in the last 18 months of his life, it meant we had to uncover original footage. And one of our first meetings with John Charlton, Jack's son, who was with Jack on his staff throughout that Irish period, John said, listen, Craig Johnston, the former footballer, Liverpool player, who was still playing at that time, was around us with a camera. He was working for UNICEF, who had some sort of partnership with FIFA during that tournament. So get hold of Craig Johnston. So we got hold of Craig Johnston. And we continued to try and get hold of Craig Johnston, and we rang him up, and he moved from LA to back to Australia. And he said, yeah, I've got this footage. Yeah, I know where it is. It's in my garage, but I'm unpacking my things. A long story, short story. Eventually, Pete Thomas, my co-director, flew to Sydney, met with Craig. They went into his garage, unpacked a box. Pete came back with what he hoped, because he couldn't look at the tapes. Whilst he was in Sydney, he came back with what he hoped was the material that we were after. And lo and behold, we had this footage in amongst other footage of Craig with the fans, Craig in the crowd at the Romania game, which is also unseen footage, which gives you a wonderful sense of that occasion. We had this incredible sing-song that was done, as you say, just after the game against Italy, Ireland's peak moment in their football history. And we've been told about this by Andy Townsend and Niall Quinn, who we interviewed. Yeah, I remember. So to then to actually see those pictures, very well filmed, it has to be said by Craig, you know, unlike maybe some of the other material that we got, was fantastic. And yeah, we let it run as much as we could as its own scene. And it captures not only the sort of sense of a unique spirit, which that team had, but as you say, a sort of sense of the sadness of the night initially, moving into more of a sense of celebration in each other's company. And it was so important that we got that material, because you hear so much about the crack and wasn't it a wonderful time, and Jack created a great team spirit and Jack was a wonderful leader. And it's great to hear those anecdotes, but for a documentary maker, you have to illustrate it. Mm. You have to capture it. So to find that footage, and I'm really glad that it stuck out to you, because I think it will to every Irish fan, was fantastic.
It jumped out a mile. You can imagine this team the next time they take the pitch, how together they are. You know, that's a powerful thing they had going on. It was lovely.
Yeah. And we got bits and pieces as well from another source of just on the coach, you know, during that period as well. Little bits and pieces, which again, were just authentic. It just authenticates a lot of what is said. And that's vital when you're dealing a lot of the times in, you know, autobiographies, and we're long before, of course, the mobile phone era. So it was fantastic to get that material and crucial for the film.
So much of this film, it's interspersed then with scenes from the modern day Charlton household and Jack, you know, struggling very much with dementia, and his heroic family all around him, supporting him as best they can and trying to have good days with him. Were they hesitant to let you in and see Jack in, you know, the throes of this illness? Were they very enthusiastic about doing that? How does that door open?
Well, it opened, we had the original conversation with John, Andy Townsend and I, and he's the executive producer and obviously was Jack's captain in 94. And Andy rang up John Charlton a couple of years ago. We went up to the Northeast. We met with the family. We actually met with John and Jack at John's pub in the Northeast. Jack came along for a pint and recognized Andy. But we knew at that point that Jack wouldn't be doing any interviews and that he was living with dementia. And the family, we followed the family's guidance, really. So we said we wanted to do scenes where Jack is still living, you know, living with dementia, yes, but still enjoying his life. So you'll see in the film with his grandchildren, back at the pub, having lunch, going for a walk with his wife, fishing, at his fishing charity, which he had for years. These were scenes that we discussed with the family, and we followed their lead on it in the same way that we said we would like to show Jack some footage from back in the day. We would like Jack to listen to Blade and Races, which obviously we have him singing back in the day in the film. So we followed their lead, and when they felt that maybe we'd got enough that day, when Jack was getting a bit tired, then we stopped filming. And obviously we had to be sensitive to that. But also, one of the things that we noticed during the filming was that Jack engaged with the camera still. One of the first moments you'll see in the film of Jack from this modern footage is him talking to the camera. And it was important that we did that, and we got a sense of that, because Jack always liked the camera, and it was one of his great strengths. And I think at various times in the filming, we did get the sense that he was certainly aware of what was happening and certainly engaging with the camera. And to me, that was, I know it's poignant, but it also felt very inspirational.
He was, and you know, I'm kind of, Jack's time in my world is very much childhood. So I haven't appreciated until adulthood just how bloody good he is in front of a camera right through his life. I didn't realize he presented television shows effectively about his home area, and man, charisma and just everything about him was magnetic. I mean, he was, you would appreciate this as a man who has to try and be good in front of a camera. This guy was seriously good in front of a camera.
Well, I knew that footage existed because I'd seen bits of it in you know, working at ITV and researching other films and pieces. And Jack in sort of towards the end of his playing career, not only had he taken all his coaching badges, not only had he won all these medals, but yeah, he was presenting shows for Tyne Tees Television in the Northeast, naturally doing pieces to camera where he's walking in the wind and the rain, a good minute's worth of speaking time. He was an absolute natural. He was hugely interested in social, political, culture, history as well in his area, and made a series of programs about that. He was across a lot of the issues at the time, like the miners' strike that affected his area, and did it with a sort of natural charm and wit, which connected. And
is
I
the
think
word,
that
yeah.
natural charm and wit obviously is what enabled him to connect as well with Ireland. That straightforward authenticity, which he had. So it was really important in the film that we reflected that, and we could have included more of that, although the footage is pretty costly. It was really good to see that. I'm glad it stood out to you because it does give you a real sense. And we had to do that again with the film to pull away some of the layers, or rather to get to the layers underneath the sort of gruff stereotype, the flat cap, the tactics. Of course, there was much more to that, I think, than meets the eye. And so it was really good to have that footage to show. Yeah. In addition, of course, to the notes that we found, which his family had, which also give you a real deeper insight, I think, into what was going on inside Jack's head.
They sure do. I'll come to them, these handwritten notes, which have survived. When there's a point in your piece where Jack and family are sitting down and they're watching some of his presentation, and he's got Pat on one side and his granddaughter on the other. And after a period, he says, "That's me." And then he turns to his granddaughter, you know, it's just most beautiful moment that you're capturing, and says, "That's me, and I don't even know, you know, I have no memory of it," is what he's saying to her, and she laughs. And there's moments like that which will stand the test of time. So you show him various pieces of footage, different games, and he's in the kitchen watching Irish footage. And you know, we the context here is very sad. There are you know, his memory is clearly in a terrible state. Like Pat at one stage turns to him and says, "They think a lot of you in Ireland, don't they?" And he looks at her and says, "I don't know." And you think,
I've
no idea. And you think of the amount that has been forgotten there, which is just hard to fathom. And then cut to kitchen, another stage in your movie, and he's watching the Irish team walking into the stadium, and we see Paul McGrath, and after a beat or two, he simply says, "Paul McGrath," and turns to the camera, you know, aware that that's there as well, and smiles. And McGrath is probably the central contributor in many respects. He certainly will, you know, linger in the memory the longest of this piece. I'm curious, was that pre-planned on your part, or did you realize some way into this that actually McGrath should be a focal point of this story?
No, it was pre-planned to a degree. I read Paul's book, which is incredible, and we got a sense from that, I think, of just the demons that were working inside Paul at that time. And also reading sort of material and listening to some of Jack's interviews, we did a lot of that research, obviously, before we did the filming process and the structural process. Now, Paul was always going to be a narrative arc in his own right, because of where that narrative arc ends up, which is that wonderful game, the peak, really, of the Charlton era in New York. In 1994, when Paul essentially played himself even further into the hearts of the Irish nation and maybe gained the status then of the greatest Irish footballer of all time. Mm. That's certainly the way I think Jack and many of players from that team feel about it. So now Paul was always going to be part of it. When Paul spoke and we went down to see him, it's not natural for him to do interviews. I know he's doing more and more of it, which is great, but especially when he's being asked about his own background. But Paul spans many sort of aspects of the sort of social and cultural aspect of what Ireland was at that time, because of his own specific circumstances. And of course, the way that Jack treated him tells you an awful lot more about Jack, I think, the manager, than people might have expected.
Yeah, yeah. There's loads in this. I mean, I don't want to give away too much. There's loads in this people may not have heard before. For instance, Paul tells a story of when he couldn't get off the bus one day and really wasn't in a good place. And later that evening at the hotel, Jack just came over to him and said, "Sorry, son, I didn't realize, you know, you had it so bad," and kind of left him at it. Like these moments of tenderness between them, a vulnerability, I suppose, between them. And in his notes, which he hand wrote and the family kept, there's loads of great parallels, you must enjoy, they must enjoy. And, you know, they did. Be a dictator, but be a kind one. All of these things and handwritten notes on players. Any of them jump out to you when you were going through them?
Well, those ones, you've named a few there. What jumped out to me was that, a lot of those notes were written on sort of the back of menus. They were written on small pieces of paper, written sort of team sheets. So they were done in a very sort of impulsive way. You know, Jack had his pen, his marker pen, and he just scribbled things down. They were coming into his head.
Yes.
But they were moments that, so it was all very, again, all very authentic, but not, you know, by no means some sort of ordered dossier, which I think is you would expect that to be the case. What I didn't expect was the, I don't want to say I'm patronizing here, but the sort of depth of thought and the simplicity, the genius in a lot of what he was writing down there. You know, the sort of thing, the sort of leadership values that people pay an awful lot of money to hear someone like, some industry leader at a speech say. Well, Jack was writing that sort of thing down, like you say, make it so they want to come. Be a dictator, but be a nice one. You're never at your... You're never stronger than when you first take a job. So he's not only writing down tactical things about what he thinks about David O'Leary or how wonderful he thinks Paul McGrath might be, and a few little lines about the opposition, but it's that those broader bits of philosophy in terms of football style and leadership and how he is going to deal with people, loyalty in massive capital letters.
Yeah.
You know, and that obviously spans essentially a lot of Jack's life. Mantra. Those were excellent to get, and they, as I say, with Jack not being able to give us an up-to-date interview, to a degree the notes were able to cross-reference a lot of the things that we would have been talking about anyway.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, the fact that he can't give you up-to-date thoughts is such a gap in it. And yet it's the whole point of it as well, you know, like there are just so many moments where Bobby Charlton archive tells a story about Jack punching him. And you know, Bobby even says, I don't know if Jack could remember that now. This is back, you know, back before he was diagnosed with dementia, obviously. And obviously we don't know Jack's version of events. And it's, you know, it's amazing the motif or the theme of memory is throughout. Like you have Jack towards the end of his Irish tenure talking about how he hopes he's given the people of Ireland memories that last a lifetime. You've players talking about memory back in the day, you know, in real time, the memory. Paddy Bonner talking about when there's emotion involved, you remember it for the rest of your life. And then, you know, jarringly you cut to the Charlton household, and that's patently not true in this terrible case. But like, There's a lot going on there, and what memory means, Gabriel, in terms of who we are and how each day is put into context. I'm sure that's been at the forefront of your mind a lot during this whole
year. Absolutely right, and it was important. That was important why we got, if you like, a third neutral voice in the shape of Dr. Michael Gray, who's leading research into one of the guys, along with Willie Stewart in Scotland, who's leading a research group into dementia in football. And it's not a film about football and dementia. We touch on that, but it's not a film about that. But clearly, the aspect of dementia and memory, and this idea that your identity is formed by your memories. And it was important, therefore, to get a neutral voice in there who could give certainly me a sense, and hopefully the viewer a sense, of that broader understanding of it. And how, to a degree, when he says in the film, for instance, when the person living with dementia isn't able to remember things, they go to a sort of general answer like, I've no idea. That's the coping mechanism for them, which was Jack's coping mechanism. But deep down, he suggested there's a sense of remorse when you can't remember things.
Yeah.
And you can identify with that, I think, when you see Jack, and you can understand that. But equally, there's a sense of pride and achievement when you can remember things. So, and when still you're able to recognize Paul McGrath, for instance, or a song, you're able to go back to that place. And certainly, yeah, memory and getting a broader sense of memory and how important it is to us was vital to the film. And I hope that comes across. And also this sense, I think, that Jack, I know you talked about Jack being missing and there's a gap there, but I hope that with the interviews that we managed to get and research, Jack is present in so much of the film through his previous interviews.
Yeah, he is.
I feel that he would have still said many of those things again. He's narrating the match in Belfast, for instance. He's narrating up to the start of the penalty shootout. He's narrating, obviously, to a degree, the story with his brother as well. So we knew that we had that body of interviews to go back to and to start from. So I hope in that sense, and I think the family feel that way, that he's very much the key presence in the film.
No, he certainly is.
Not just this shadow of himself.
No, his voice is powerful in it, you know, and remains so. Dr. Michael Gray, even though he doesn't pop up that often in the piece, what he says really lingers. You know, you talked there about the not being able to remember and then sometimes being able to remember and the coping mechanism. He also made the point that just because in that moment they can't remember doesn't mean that they don't realize something's wrong here. You know, they're very aware, there's a remorse and there's a sense that I feel, you know, there's an expectation I should be able to remember. And that's such a horrible, poignant thought. And then he speaks, Dr. Michael Gray, over footage of Jack very recently at the Jack Charlton. I think it's a charity for, you know, that uses fishing, I think, for people with various issues or illnesses. I can't quite remember. Right,
yeah. But yeah, Disabled Anglers Fishing disabled. Association. Jack back for a lot of his life.
Yes, yes. And Dr. Michael Gray is explaining how, you know, there's a real bravery in continuing to do the things Jack was doing, as in he was in this tent with lots of different people and he might have known where he was, why he was there, who he was talking to. And then this piece of footage where Jack feels like he's going to fall over. And I'm not sure the gentleman alongside him fully appreciates that Jack's in a bit of distress. Maybe he does, but it didn't seem that way. And that lingers, you know, that there is a bravery in not hiding away, and he didn't.
I hope so, yeah, because I think possibly the hardest scenes for the family.
Yeah.
And I think the family, you know, the family are keen to emphasize in the film that they don't feel that Jack's dementia is linked to football. Certainly his son says that. Now, and of course, we'll never know for definite with Jack, but his wife is willing to embrace, obviously, the argument that like a boxer who's taken a lot of punches, heading the ball, which the heavy ball, which they did back in that day, may well have contributed to Jack's dementia. But I think when you're confronted, if you like, with the sight of the man that you loved and had seen in so many ways as such a strong figure, being fragile, it's certainly hard. But I do think as well that the sense of a person being able to live with dementia and carry on is certainly one that the family wanted to put across. It's certainly something that the Alzheimer's Society, when we've been dealing with them in the UK and in Ireland, have been keen to emphasize, that you are still able to live your life, and that hopefully now more and more research will happen so that we're seeing less and less of these types of issues moving forward. But I think that's really important, so that as hard as those days might be for Jack, he was inspiring those around him still. He was inspiring the guys at the Disabled Anglers Association. He was inspiring for his grandchildren. He was still doing it and still living his life. And, you know, we were filming until a week before Jack passed away, doing less and less. But he was still up and he was still about as much as he could possibly be.
Yes, and I don't want to give give some of the impression that he wasn't, because even at that on that tough day, at other points he is connecting just beautifully with them. There was a gentleman there learning issues, and like Jack is connecting with him, and you know, kid laughing, and like gorgeous as well. You know, so when you talk living with dementia, yes, that was a difficult day in some respects, but in other respects, I mean, I haven't connected with anyone like that today. I don't know about you. You know, like it was gorgeous.
No, absolutely. Yeah, what an inspiring figure still, towards the end of his life, for a young man. You know, and yeah, I think it was vital for us to put those scenes in the film, and we're so privileged and grateful to the family to have allowed us to do that. Because I think as difficult as it is for them at times, that they know that Jack remained an inspirational figure.
A last broad area I just wanted to ask you about, Gabriel. The Bobby relationship is central here as well, and such a complex one. Two complex people, complex relationship, a lot to unpack. So what was your sense of those two and their relationship?
A difficult relationship. I looked as closely as I could at the archive, and it's amazing how much archive there was, how famous, you know, I didn't know how famous these two guys were, you know, at 1959, 1960, when they were making black and white television then, you know, at the start of television, really. Bobby and Jackie Charlton were famous. You know, they were pinups. They were the Charlton brothers, who one was at Manchester United, one was at Leeds United, two of the biggest clubs in England. Television and football and Match of the Day was just getting started, and there they were. So they lived in the public eye from a very early time, and yet there is not much of the two of them together. And what often you see of the two of them together, from that early footage, is pretty cold in relation to where they talk about each other, or raw, or just up front. That's just the way they were. And they're very different characters. It's clear. It's not a cliche. It's clear that they are. One of the key things that we uncovered, because it was hardly shown, I think, at the time, was an interview that they did for the BBC just after the Romania victory. So at Jack's peak in 1990, and Bobby was a pundit with the BBC, and I'd been tipped off by Jim Neely, actually, Northern Ireland broadcaster. I came to a game in Dublin just before lockdown, a Six Nations game, and I met Jim in the press room. We were talking about the film, and he said, yeah, I did an interview with the two of them. I said, really? Our wonderful archivist hasn't uncovered it. Surprise, surprise. And we found it. So during lockdown, we managed to find this interview that Jim did with Bobby and Jack. And it's one of, I think, the only time, I think, when Jack was Ireland manager, certainly, that Bobby congratulates him and says how proud he is of him. So to show that to the family is a really nice moment. But it's bookended, if you like. The bookends in the film are very much about how their relationship was difficult. And it became more difficult after Italia 90. And it wasn't resolved. There was no happy ending. No. John Charlton says in the film, we'd all like a happy ending. Both him and Pat Charlton were pretty frank about how there was a distance between the two brothers. And it remained that way. And we wanted to talk to Sir Bobby. Lady Norma Charlton, his wife, got back to me, and she said that, I'm afraid Sir Bobby won't be able to talk to you because he too is living with dementia. And that's obviously when that story, if you like, the film got that story, which was then released when the film came out, just before it came out. So, like many other families, and this is the way that Jack's family certainly approach it, there was a distance there between two brothers who you'd have thought would have had so much more in common, but they were united in blood, but very different as men.
Yeah. There's some great archive footage of them that you do include, though, not least Jack handing over some dead animals to Bobby, and that's worth seeing. If nothing else, I can't work out if Bobby, because Bobby's not shocked that Jack's handing him a pheasant and a hare out of his boot, but can't work out if he's going to throw it over the nearest ditch as soon as Jack goes, or if he's like, oh, you know, I will hang these up for a week like you're telling me to.
Our suspicion is that it's the former of those two. Bobby won't be taking those home to Norma.
No. Listen, it's just beautifully done, and it's obviously sad to see the end of Jack's life, but really important as well, because this shouldn't be taboo, and there should be no shame about living with dementia, and it should be, well, this is Jack now, and it all comes through, and there are moments of great joy in that as well as the terrible sadness. And look, the football stuff is done beautifully, and it was great to see some footage I hadn't seen before. So it's great. I think people will really enjoy it over the next month or so. Finding Jack. So if people Google that for a start, it will give them the various pieces of information. Absolutely, in the various locations.
Finding Jack Charlton, it's on all your major platforms. It'll have a television premiere as well in Ireland in March, when it also has a BBC premiere here. And of course, we really hope that it's going to be available in cinemas. We'll keep you updated on that, obviously, depending on lockdown issues, both sides of the Irish Channel.
Okay. Well, Gabriel Clark, congrats on finding Jack Charlton, and we'll talk to you again sometime. Thanks very much.
I hope so, Joe. Thank you very much.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power,
fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunluie.net.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.